I know some people had hope that the Trump administration would represent some kind of break with the past. And there's been some break in methodology, right? But ultimately, again, the U.S. doesn't, the Trump administration doesn't even intend to abandon hegemony. They just want to force the rest of the world to pay for it. So as far as I'm concerned, battle lines are drawn. Now the Chinese are stepping up to the plate as well.
Mark, you mentioned the case of Yemen. We know that in Yemen, Donald Trump has decided to go and fight them. They say this time is going to be different. We're not going to fight the way that the Biden administration was implementing, was doing. It's going to be something different. And we know that they tried everything against Yemen, short of nuclear bombs. And even bunker buster bombs, they tried, they have failed. And CNN reported $1 billion they have used in a short period of time.
And how, not just $1 billion, but $1 billion worth of missiles and air defense missiles that the U.S. is already short of both on and can't afford, right? Continuing to supply Ukraine, right, on one hand, a war with Iran on the other, continuing to play whack-a-mole in the desert against the Houthis. Oh, we're supposed to be preparing to solve this missile gap with China. U.S. is militarily overstretched, right? And this senseless game of whack-a-mole against the Houthis, the missiles and the air defense missiles that are expended and have not stopped the Houthis from continuing to launch their own strikes, you know, on Israeli allied shipping or on Israel itself. I don't see what's different myself. I can't identify anything that is different. I mean, if they think that they're going after more general targets, it hasn't had any effect yet, right? I mean, it's killed more Yemenis, but that just generates more willing Ar-Ansalah movement, you know, recruitments, right? I mean, that's the same problem that Israel is having in Gaza. Yes, they've been going after Hamas for, you know, over a year now, you know, going on 2 years. And has that significantly reduced Hamas's numbers? No, because for every Israeli civilian they kill, or a Palestinian civilian they kill, they just generate two or three more Hamas members. That's the same thing here. The Houthis have endured years of U.S.-backed Saudi and UAE bombing and airstrikes and everything on their country, and they took it. And they know how to hide things. They know how, you know, and to distribute things. And you can take out a launcher here and this there. And they're already the poorest country in the world, and no one can deal with them militarily.
Mark, they were short of targets in Yemen. That's why Donald Trump should share a video that they're killing civilians.
Yeah,
it's unbelievable.
I don't know what they think. I have heard repeatedly they have launched this rumor has been leaking out of Washington that they're considering sending ground troops into Yemen. I imagine in the Kremlin they're just like, do it. Beijing, right?
Do it,
right? Everyone's like, yeah, you need to get stuck in another Middle East quagmire like that, right? I can't believe. I want to say that I don't believe the Trump administration is stupid enough to do something like that, but hey, they just launched tariffs against the world and were forced to walk them back within a week. So I can't even say that, you know, maybe they will, maybe, you know, they actually could. I don't think it's likely, but I think the Pentagon would try to talk them out of it because they're a little more level-headed to a degree. The U.S. just has too many problems. They're too overstretched. They've got this particularly, again, their Achilles heel right now for the U.S. military is their shortage and their inability in the short term, probably through the medium term, to ramp up the production of missiles and air defense missiles, right? That they both need for a conflict with Iran, for a conflict with China, or to continue escalating a conflict with Russia in Ukraine. They're overstretched, and then their military industrial complex is not up to meeting that challenge now. And they can't even beat the Houthis. And they think that they're going to take on China and the Taiwanese Straits and the South China Sea. Man, it's madness. It's just divorced. It's a divorce from reality and an unwillingness to admit that the U.S. is just not a hyperpower anymore, not in relation to the rest of the world. There's been too much proliferation of missile technology and drone technology and AIs and everything else. It's a new military world. The U.S. just, you know, they can be first among equals and still not able to defeat the Houthis in Yemen. That's, you know, says something about the state of warfare in the world and how much state power can be brought to bear on any particular problem with the goal of solving ultimately a political issue. Doesn't work. So, you know, again, that Trump realizes how much he needs Russia, and he is looking for leverage, or for Russia to not use leverage in this particular situation. If they start using words like demand, well, that's going to be a mistake. I mean, that is not the way it's going to work. Russia and Iran have a new and improved strategic partnership. It was just ratified by the Russian Senate in the last 24 hours. If Trump is smart, or any of his people are smart, that Witkoff will be coming hat in hand and asking for Russian assistance, right, on this. You know, and Russia doesn't want Iran to have nuclear weapons, but what they're providing Iran with, most people assess as part of their strategic partnership, is a conventional deterrent in the form of Russia helping Iran build up an air defense and electronic warfare network in the country. Now, of course, the U.S. and Israel are furious about that. But, you know, they're not going to get everything they want in Iran. If they think they are, they're badly mistaken. So could there be some type of deal struck, right? Is that what Witkoff is there? You know, we'll do this on Ukraine if you do this on Iran. Russia doesn't like these sort of things, these promises behind the back, this week and the nod, right? Gorbachev, you know, was promised such things about the expansion of NATO and the like. And, you know, we all know how that ended. And I think Russia is would demand a lot more than promises from the Trump administration, right? And they're not likely to sell out Iran. They're willing to deal as a mediator with Iran, right? But they will do that from a different level, not, you know, selling them out, you know, in the back alley. That's not what Russia, I think, would do at all. What Putin could, you know, get out of this, again, is, you know, you want our help on this. You want our help negotiating with Iran and saving yourself another war and some face there. Well, then you need to walk away from Ukraine. We don't care how you do it. That is maybe something that is being discussed. I would think that probably the reality is not quite that big and sexy. The reality is probably on a lower level of that rather than, you know, such general terms, but you know, we'll find out going forward.
It's not just the case of Iran, it's the case of Ukraine. It was the case of Ukraine, if you remember, the way that the Biden administration somehow was forcing Iran and China especially not to help Russia during the conflict in Ukraine. They did everything. They sent a lot of people, officials to China to talk with them. But Mark, in my opinion, what's going on, the main target is China. We know that what's going on in Ukraine, how important Ukraine is for Russia, and what's important for Iran, and what's going on with Iran in the Middle East. But when you see the links all get to Beijing, all get to China and the competition, they wanted to weaken Russia, which wasn't working, it didn't work. And right now it seems that the Middle East, we know that how important Middle East is in terms of the security for Russia and China. Yeah, exactly. China, that's why I'm talking about the main target is China. I would wonder how China sees this sort of position of the United States in the Middle East.
Well, I mean, I think you're seeing where China is by their quid pro quo tit for tat tariff hikes right now up to 125% on U.S. goods. China is in a fighting mood, right? I mean, when I say fighting, I don't know, of course, that literally mean war, right? I don't think that's necessarily right on the cards, but they're not going to kowtow or deal with the Trump administration, right? In fact, I think they probably correctly believe that if they showed any weakness whatsoever, that Trump would just work to exploit and take advantage of that, or, you know, read it as weakness, you know, rather than a willingness to negotiate, to find, you know, zero sum options and positive for everyone, that sort of thing that the Chinese love talking about. But the real question is, of course, can you separate Russia and China, or Russia and China and Iran now? Right. I mean, it all goes back to this clip of Joe Biden in the 90s, then as on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, this video that's out. Probably most of the people out there watching this have already seen this, where Joe Biden was laughing about pushing then NATO expansion down Russia's throat, and that the Russians had came to him and said, well, if you keep doing this, we're going to have to turn to China. And he thought that was funny. And he's like, you turn to China, right? Like, are you serious? Right? What are you going to turn to Iran next? Right? You know, we're the only game in town. You've got no one else to go to. You're just going to have to take it. He thought that was funny, right? Where are we today? Right. Yeah. Is Russia and China and Iran have been pushed together by the United States, and they keep looking for space. They keep looking for a gap, something to wedge into and exploit between Russia and China and Iran. And in the last 3 years of the conflict in Ukraine, they haven't found it, and they've been looking really hard for it, right? The Biden administration's focus was on Russia. Right. They wanted to finish Russia off and move on to China and ignore the Middle East. But instead, they ended up getting stuck on Russia in Ukraine and losing that. but they couldn't get China to stop trading with Russia. They couldn't get Russia and Iran were doing active, have been doing active military exchange and cooperation, now strengthening, you know, as well as vastly improving economic relations with the North-South corridor and as well. So it's not a question of it's all about China, because at this point, it's not just China. It's Russia, China, and Iran, and you know, potentially some others as well, and looking to try to find, you know, the light of day in between the three of them. And they're having a hard problem. And there's, I think, maybe at some level, realizing the geopolitical catastrophe that they have produced by pushing these three countries together, you know, rather than using a divide and conquer that Nixon and Kissinger did with the you know, exploiting the Sino-Soviet split, you know, they tried to take on all three at the same time out of arrogance, right? Out of belief that they didn't have to compromise with any one of them. And it's led them to this situation, right? And they want to go after Iran. They've got to deal with Russia, and they've got to consider China. They want to, you know, a trade war with China. Well, then now they have to consider their trade with Russia and with Iran. They keep, it's circular. They keep looking, you know, for an in against one, and they find themselves confronted always by the other two now. Right. You know, even without some type of formal alliance, you know, military alliance between the three, that may not even be necessary, because they just to such a high degree, their foreign policy and their national interests have reached a point of convergence. And it's really a question for that the entire world should regard, that the stability, you know, primarily of the Russian-Chinese bipolar relationship as the single most important bilateral relationship in the world, right? The foundation of a multipolar world is the Russian-Chinese partnership. And it, the first extension of that is the Russian-Chinese-Iranian partnership. And a multipolar world will rise or sink on the stability of, you know, first the Russian-Chinese relationship, and then the triad, you know, the tripole relationship of Russia, China, Iran. And then eventually, you know, maybe other countries can be added into that. But for instance, China directly spoke to India over the last few days and said, "You need to, you should side with us against Trump's trade war." And the Indians are like, "Crickets chirping. We're gonna cut a deal behind closed doors with the U.S. and we think we'll have a deal with the autumn. But good luck with that. Good luck with that. Right? India is not at a place yet where they are willing to break with the West and contribute to the stability of that multiple. Maybe someday they will be, but they're not there now. That's for sure. They're still trying to have it good both ways, and they can't. Brazil is too far afield geopolitically, too concerned with domestic matters, it seems to me. Lula's options are tied. He doesn't want to become the object of U.S. wrath. So Brazil is mostly staying quiet. But every once in a while, they get demands from the U.S. like to provide artillery shells to Ukraine, and Lula's throws him the finger when he can, what he can do, and the like. Brazil, of course, is not in the same position as Russia or China, so they have to be more careful. But, you know, there is potential. And we're looking forward to a moment on May 9th which is Victory Day, and it is the 80th anniversary of the defeat of Nazi Germany and its European fascist allies. Xi Jinping is going to be there, right? The Chinese leader. And there are reports, again, that Modi and Lula will be there as well. That is a significant show of strength by Russia and of the multipolar world standing together. I can't imagine. I think the Western press will probably mostly just try to ignore that whole thing and not mention it. They don't even like to mention BRICS, right? They just try not to talk about it, I think, as well. But that is going to be a moment, and it's coming, you know, it will be in the midst of what I'm sure will be an ongoing trade war going on, and Trump will be increasingly getting desperate, not getting what he wants from Russia on Ukraine. And it will just be a show of unity, right? And I think, you know, of a proper remembrance of history as well. Of course, that's in there as well. But I think that will be an important event. I think that will be, as far as, you know, such symbolic events will go, it will be an important one. And it will show that there is a degree of unity between the BRICS members, right? Beyond just rhetoric, because all coming to Moscow to stand together, there's political capital that will be expended in that.
And I don't think that Donald Trump wants, in the case of Ukraine, he wants to get out. And I don't see, as you mentioned, I don't see they want a war with Iran, because they have, this administration had the same experience that the Biden administration had with the case of Yemen. They know what would be the disaster. This is just, China just doesn't need to do anything. Just sitting and watching the United States melting down.
Putin was just asked a question about his position on this tariff war between, you know, the global tariffs, but in particular, you know, the tariff war developing between the U.S. and China. And he related a proverb monkeys looking down out of the tree and seeing two tigers fighting. And, you know, the one monkey says, well, what should we do? And, you know, the wise monkey, you know, says we should sit back and do nothing and, you know, let your enemy self-destruct. In this case, of course, you know, Russia, of course, does not see China as an enemy, but they're certainly not going to wade into this trade dispute as well. They're not, of course, or they're not going to stop trade with China at U.S. demand either, of course. They will give China, in its moment of confrontation with the U.S., you know, an equal level of support that China gave Russia over the last few years, right? Now, China will become the tip of the spear, perhaps, instead of Russia. But this is all factored on Trump, though, finding a way out of the Ukraine mess. And I'm not so sure that he will be able to find and maneuver his way out of that mess, because he's still the U.S. president. And the minute he became president, he owned that war against Russia, right? And he doesn't want to continue it, but he also doesn't want to lose. And that's what it would be, the U.S. losing a war against Russia. So it's a very tough thing. There are so much domestic and international political forces bent on the continuation of that conflict because they can't accept a Russian victory. Right now, can they avert it? No, that's not something that, but you know, pointing out that logical flaw is not something. They will hope for a black swan that something will change until, you know, well past it's all over. But they will not give in because it is ideological. It is, you know, a question of exceptionalism and their view of themselves and their place in the world and what Russia's, and of course, Iran and China's proper place in that world is or is not. So they just can't accept a Russian victory. So they might want, once again, to pivot to China. But I think they're probably going to get stuck with Russia and the Middle East again, just like the Biden administration did.